On the 7th of January, just under 3 weeks ago, some gunmen walked into the Charlie Hebdo offices in Paris and shot 12 people dead. Around the same time, another gunman went into a kosher supermarket and killed 4 Jewish people. One other person died in that flurry of violence in France. And the world reacted with a passion. If you went on Twitter that day, it was full everywhere with everyone tweeting hashtag Je suis Charlie. And there was a sense, that was the great phrase that captured the imagination. Je suis Charlie. I am Charlie. If you attack them, you attack me. You are attacking something absolutely precious to us as people. And it was taken very widely within our own world as an attack on freedom of speech. And that, of course, is one of the most treasured values in our modern European Western society. Of course, after that, about a week later, on the Sunday, there was that march of around 1.5 million people in Paris, other marches around the world, and it spread everywhere. Last week, I was in Israel, in Jerusalem, and all over Jerusalem were these posters up saying, Jerusalem et Charlie. Everyone seemed to identify with this campaign, as it were. And then, of course, Charlie Hebdo, the magazine, produced their first edition after this atrocity. And on the front was a cartoon of Muhammad. And, of course, that, in turn, caused riots across the Muslim world. So here we have this conflict, this incident that's happened in our world recently, and it's raised all kinds of significant issues for us. Now, when it first happened, I remember going on Twitter and seeing this hashtag all over the place, and I think everyone who heard about the attack was horrified by it, and there was a sense of wanting to say something. And I remember being about to tweet something about it and almost wanting to do the hashtag Je suis Charlie thing. But then something held me back. And I found myself not quite wanting to say that. I wasn't sure whether I was Charlie or not. And it wasn't, of course, because I had any sympathy at all for the jihadists, the people who carried out that outrage. But at the same time, I didn't find I could quite ally myself with what Charlie Hebdo were trying to do at the same time. While I found myself appalled by what these jihadists did and grieving for the families and friends and colleagues of those who died, at the same time I found myself reluctant to tweet Je suis Charlie because I didn't really want to support the freedom to offend and to insult because that's not the kind of freedom I wanted to defend either. And so it seems to be here in this incident we have a clash between two very, very different views of the world. You have a clash between secularism and Islamism. Two very different sets of values. We have a clash between, on the one hand, secularism, our secular liberal society, that basically says that the freedom is the freedom to choose. It's the freedom to decide for myself. It's the freedom to say, to tweet, to draw what I like. And no government or authority or religion or dogma can tell me to do anything other. Now, I am free, and I must be free to pursue whatever path of life I choose, whatever dream I may follow, as every Walt Disney film tells us. I can choose my clothes, my car, my job, my religion, my lifestyle, if I can afford it, that is. And I can exercise my freedom to say what I want. And no one could tell me otherwise. Freedom of choice, freedom of speech is one of the things we treasure most in our society. It's the ultimate good for us. But of course, that view of freedom comes with a number of problems. Choice is fine, but sometimes it just gets a little bit too much. I don't know if you ever tried to buy a mobile phone recently. You go into the O2 shop, and it is bewildering. the number of choices you have to make. It's not just like you can go in and just say, right, I'm going to just buy a phone. I'll buy a phone, take it away, and go. You have to choose. What model are you going to take? Is it a Samsung or is it an iPhone? Or, you know, what tariff are you going to have? What color is it going to be? How many free minutes or how many expensive minutes? What sort of deal are you going to have? It is incredibly confusing. It's the same with buying jeans. I bought myself a pair of jeans recently, these ones here. I hope you like them. But it was immensely confusing. There I was in Gap, faced by, am I going to buy sort of skinny, sort of low on the hip, high on the hip? Am I going to buy, you know, drain pipes, flares? Am I going to buy the baggy ones? Am I going to buy, you know, worn ones with sort of holes in the knee? You know, it was just incredibly confusing. There was a book that came out recently by a writer called Barry Schwartz called The Paradox of Choice. And he says this: there comes a point at which opportunities become so numerous that we just feel overwhelmed. Instead of feeling in control, we feel unable to cope. And that's something we experience in our freedom of choice. Of course, the other thing that freedom, our sense of freedom does in secular liberal societies like ours, is that it tends to drive us further and further away from each other. It atomizes our society into a whole collection of individuals. All of us making our own self-authenticating choices, all watching our own different TV channels in our individually designed living rooms, pursuing our own individual way through life. And it can separate us from one another. Our freedom of choice means that we have very little sense of shared values or aspirations. But even more than that, our sense of freedom of choice inevitably affects others. It's one thing to say we are all free to do what we want, but what happens when my freedom impedes upon someone else's liberty? When I go to the shop and I choose between this brand of trainers and that brand of trainers, it may well be that the choice I make actually, in some chain of effects, does affect some impoverished worker in an Asian or Latin American sweatshop who is putting them together. The choices we make as rich people sometimes affects poor people in our world more than we ever realize, people we will never even meet. The freedom of the Charlie Hebdo cartoonists impinged upon the deeply held values of millions of Muslims. Couldn't help do that. So our secular idea of freedom, total freedom of choice, freedom to do what we want, say what we want, buy what we want, doesn't come without its problems. But then on the other hand, we have a major presence in our world, that of Islam. And Islam, of course, has a very different understanding of that. The word Islam means submission. It means submission to the will of Allah. And for many Muslims and those attracted to Islam, it is a conscious rejection of precisely that vision of Western freedom that we thought about just now. Because that freedom is seen as license. And Islam, if you like, is a rejection of the West's treasured freedom to stray far from the will of God, to adopt all kinds of lifestyle choices, to have a society awash with pornography and gambling and drunkenness and all kinds of sexual behavior, lack of respect for elderly people and so on. And not only that, but exporting it to Muslim lands through the West's incursion into the sacred land of Saudi Arabia and the Gulf Wars and so on. And of course, many people in our culture, not least young Muslim men, are very attracted to that vision of order. That order of submitting your own will to the will of God. Whether that means praying five times a day, whether it means women often voluntarily adopting the hijab or the burqa, adopting rules to order life, not to eat pork, not to drink alcohol, and so on. And so we have these two very different visions of how life is to be lived: freedom or submission. And so often, every now and again, they come into conflict in a way that they did just a few weeks ago in Paris. And the words in our text today, if you keep on biting and devouring each other, watch out or you will be destroyed by each other, is quite germane for our culture today. It's a picture of that present tension that we find ourselves in. So at the heart of this issue is the issue of freedom. How do we understand freedom. And in that, just the next 10 minutes or so, I haven't got long this morning, I want to try to outline just the outlines of what a Christian understanding of freedom is. Because I sensed when I was asking, do I tweet Je suis Charlie? And I didn't want to identify with the jihadists, but neither did I really want to identify with the Charlie Hebdo cartoonists either. What I found myself groping for was, what is a Christian understanding of freedom that is different from that secularist understanding of freedom and different from the view of submission that you find within Islam? Well, four things. Four things that I think our passage for today, Galatians chapter 5, tells us about a Christian idea of freedom. And the first is that we are bound. We are bound. Our passage talks about a yoke of slavery. We think, of course, we are free to choose, but the New Testament says that we are not. You cannot read a page of the New Testament without coming across this idea that the world is, in fact, in chains to hostile powers that enslave it. And that includes us, includes you and me. In the world of St. Paul, the writer of this letter to the Galatians, the Jews were bound by the law. Gentile pagans were bound by the stoicheia tou kosmou, is the Greek phrase, the elemental spirits of the world. And the main effect of sin for St. Paul is that it enslaves us. Now, when we think about ourselves here today in 21st century Western society, we think we are free, but are we? We are, I suspect, controlled and manipulated by advertising campaigns and marketing strategies far more than we ever think. And so often they're designed to make us think that we need things that we really don't, and that we want things that actually will damage us rather than help us. We think we are free, but we are not. So often we think we want something, but that want has been created by an alien force working upon us. And we are pulled this way and that by our desires for food, for sex, for fame, for honor, for money, for security, for safety, for comfort. And every now and again, we become aware of how enslaved we are. You know, you find yourself suddenly reacting with anger to something. Why did I do that? And you realize you are not free to choose. That something has taken control of you. You find yourself acting out of greed or resentment or jealousy. And you suddenly realize, actually, I'm not as free as I thought I was. And even more, sometimes we become aware of addictions that grip hold of us, addictions to pornography or to alcohol or to food. And we wish we could be free. That's the sharp end of it. But you don't have to have a kind of major addiction to realize that every single one of us is an addict to sin. We are not, the New Testament says, neutral agents free to choose whether we do good or whether we do evil. There is in our nature, ever since the sin of Adam, a bias in our nature, an instinct to choose our interests over those of others, an instinct to ignore those who need our help if it's going to really inconvenience us, an instinct to be jealous of those who succeed and so on. We think we're free, but we are not. We think we're free to do what we want, but often what we want is precisely the problem. We are bound to do what we want. We are bound to follow the desires of our hearts. And it's what we want that is often the problem. So there is the first thing that the New Testament tells us about freedom, is that actually in our natural state we don't have it. We are bound. But the second thing the New Testament tells us is that Christ sets us free. It is for freedom that Christ has set us free, says our passage. And on the cross and in the resurrection, we're told that Jesus took on the powers that enslave, and he defeated them. And so as a result, St. Paul proclaims the good news that the Jews are no longer bound by the law that tells them that they have to be circumcised, that they have to follow the food laws if they are to be part of the people of God. And he's able to proclaim to the Gentiles that these mysterious powers that bind them, Their power has been broken. And the gospel is, at the end of the day, a declaration of freedom. It says, we are free in Christ. That if our faith is in Christ and in his death and in his resurrection, we are free. We are forgiven. We are ransomed. We are free from everything that enslaves us. We find a freedom from a guilty conscience. We find freedom from the demand to follow all kinds of religious laws. We find different desires starting to be birthed within our hearts, a desire to please God, a desire to follow his way, rather than our own twisted desires that end up destroying us and other people. In a strange kind of paradox, Christian freedom is the freedom not to do what I want, not to be enslaved by the desires that make me do what so often I don't really want to do. It means freedom from the compulsion to follow destructive desires and the habits of the human sinful will. Those very impulses and habits that so often destroy our relationships and our lives and our communities. So there's a second thing, that Christ sets us free. The gospel is a declaration of freedom. And the third thing that the gospel tells us about this freedom is that freedom, or a Christian understanding of freedom, is that it is a gift and not a right. We're so used to thinking in our culture ever since the Enlightenment back in the 18th century that the freedom is a right. It's an inalienable right of human beings. It's right there in the American Declaration of Independence, classic Enlightenment document if you saw one. But Christian faith tells us that freedom is not a right, it's a gift. It is not something we demand insistently, but something we receive gratefully. And that makes a huge amount of difference, because, of course, rights don't create relationship, whereas gifts do. If I claim the right to be free, I have the right to be free. I have a right to say whatever I want to do. I have a right to choose my own way of life. That doesn't create a relationship with you at all. In fact, if anything, it sets me apart from you. If freedom is a gift, it creates a bond. It creates a bond with the giver. It creates a sense of kind of almost indebtedness and obligation. Not because you have to, but because you want to. If you were a slave in the marketplace in the first century, and St. Paul knew that world very well, and if someone bought you and then set you free, you would be indebted to that person in some way. One thing you might want to do one day is to go onto the website of an organization like International Justice Mission. IJM does some fantastic work at freeing people in slavery all around the world, whether it's in sex trafficking or in unjust work practices or whatever it might be. And just read some of the stories and the testimonies of people who have been freed from real life slavery in our world today. And the note that strikes you every time you read these testimonies is the note of gratitude. That people who come out of deep injustice, people being trafficked into sexual slavery or trafficked into working effectively like slaves, unable to get out of work, paid a pittance. Once you're freed from that, there is this huge sense of gratitude. Thank you. What can I do to repay this debt? When someone risks their life to save you, you are just full of thankfulness. When you realize that someone loves you that much, it creates relationship. When someone gives you the gift of freedom, it creates that sense of indebtedness, that sense of thankfulness. And so the Christ who sets us free says, through St. Paul in that reading, you, my brothers and sisters, were called to be free, but do not use your freedom to indulge the sinful nature, but rather serve one another in love. And so in that sense of gratitude and indebtedness, as we go to Christ and we say, what can we do to thank you for this freedom you have given us? He says, well, dedicate your freedom to service, not primarily to me, but to your brother and sister, to the people who live around you, to your family, to your friends, to your church, to your work colleagues, and so on. And so this kind of freedom brings not just freedom to insult and offend. In one sense, yes, I could do that if I wish, but I don't wish. What I find when the Spirit of Christ takes root in me is that I don't want to offend and insult, because that's not an act of love. It's not an act of service to my brother and sister. It's a bit like the question, will we be free to sin in heaven? And if you ever thought of that question, will we be free to sin in heaven? And I think the answer is yes, we will, but no one will choose to. Nobody will choose to, because then we will see sin for the ugly and repulsive and horrible thing it is, and you'd never want to choose it. And we will see goodness and love for the beautiful and desirable things that they are, and we will always choose those. So freedom is a gift and not a right. And it creates relationship, and it creates this sense of bond, of indebtedness, of thankfulness and service. And so the fourth thing, and the last thing, is that Christian freedom is not so much the freedom to choose, but it's the freedom to love. It is the freedom to be who we were created to be. Creatures capable of and naturally inclined to love as God has loved us. It is the freedom to say no to myself and that greedy, whining self that always wants to be at the center of attention and that stops me reaching out in love to other people. And it's the freedom to say yes to my neighbor, to my wife, to my children, my friend, or even my enemy. It is, in this paradoxical way, a freedom to become a slave. Not because I'm forced to, but because I want to. Our passage says, the entire law is summed up in a single command. Love your neighbor as yourself. And so Christian freedom is the freedom to obey that law. To be free from the things that stop us loving. To be free from the jealousy, the resentment, the bitterness, the greed, the anger that stop us from reaching out in love to one another, that stop us being true servants of one another. And so the Christian vision of community is not like the ancient world, where some were masters and some were slaves, nor is it like the modern world, where we like to think that we're all masters and none of us are slaves. But the Christian vision of community is one where we are all free, but we gladly and happily choose to serve and honor one another, not out of compulsion, but out of freely chosen love and thankfulness. At the end of the day, the Christian life, in some ways, is quite simple. It's learning two things. It's learning that you are loved, and it's learning that you are free. It is to learn that you are loved and to learn that you are free. It's one thing to say that. It's one thing to hear it. It's another thing to really believe it in your heart. And it takes practice, learning that you are loved and learning that you are free. And in that freedom, learning to love one another, not because we have to, but because that is our deepest desire, in gratitude to the one who sets us free. Amen.